Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of polling, opinion surveys in this country. It seems today that we're used to, we may not like it, but we're used to an almost endless stream of questions from people doing surveys and taking polls. They want to know what we buy. They want to know who we think we're going to vote for. They want to know what bugs us. They want to know what we think is important. And we're also familiar with the results of these polls. It seems that every time you turn around, there is some news story about some kind of survey telling us what we think. And the fact that that's so much a part of American life now, it may surprise you that, in fact, that this kind of activity is relatively recent in American history. It was really only about in the middle of the last century that these kinds of surveys came to play a dominant role in national life. In this part of the show this morning, we will talk about this and look at some of the ways that society has been changed by the very tools that have been employed to represent it. And our guest for the program is Sarah Igoe. She is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania and has authored a book that is titled The Averaged American: Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public. It's published by the Harvard University Press out relatively recently, and we'll be talking about that in this hour. Questions, as always, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Either one works for you. You use that number, and we'd be very happy to bring you into the conversation. We only ask people to try to be brief so that we could keep things moving along. But people who are listening, they are invited to call with questions and comments. And again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Igoe, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program.
And I guess for people who are listening, I'll say we're doing this by one of these kind of high-level connections we call ISDN, which to us is nothing short of a miracle, because it's great that it sounds like she's here right with me, but she's not. She's at she's in Pennsylvania. And as I say, glad to have you with us. This, as I understand it, this book grew out of your, this was essentially, it started out as your dissertation for your PhD.
That's right.
So this is something that you'd been thinking about for some time. What was it that got you interested in trying to take a close look at the subject? And what we'll do here is look at some of the famous examples of polling that you have looked at, like the Kinsey Report and others. What got you interested in doing this as a major focus of your research?
Actually, what got me interested first, I think, was something that you've already mentioned, the relative novelty of these techniques for measuring and assessing and publicizing American life to its own citizens. I think, you know, like everybody else, I had assumed that these techniques had been around for a long time and were part of everyday life and conversation. And with just a little bit of digging, it turned out that, in fact, these polls and surveys and statistics really didn't enter American life in any public, really, until after World War I. So I became interested in this paradox that we live with these numbers and these poll results and survey results, but don't know very much about their history. These are numbers that are ubiquitous and yet rather invisible in a sense, because they're so familiar to us. Mm-hmm. And part of what I thought I might do in this book, and what I hope I did do, is attempt to understand how these numbers and statistics and results became part of everyday life.
Yeah. Just before we go into further, let me issue a correction, ladies and gentlemen. No, she's not at Pennsylvania. She's at Yale right at the moment, where she's spending time. She's on leave from University of Pennsylvania. So our thanks to the folks at Yale for being on the other end of the connection. Something that I think is interesting, and you point out in the book, is that, in fact, the kind of things that we're talking about, they before the sort of the modern era of opinion polling, there were things kind of like this done. But it's interesting to note that there was a shift of focus, and that before, what it seemed that social scientists and researchers were interested in was what in the trade we call deviance. You know, they were looking for people who were not the norm, and that what happened when we made this kind of change and started to have the kinds of surveys that we have now, there indeed they were in search of a norm. Now, you can ask exactly what that means, but they weren't looking for people who were off the average. They were looking for the average.
Yes, that's right. There is a very long history, of course, of governments and states and social reformers looking into various kinds of groups, and often in the United States anyway, but also Western Europe in the 19th century and before, the prime interest of collecting information about people, apart from censuses and taxation rolls and things like that, was to track social problems or illnesses or things of that sort. So the kind of people that came under scrutiny in 19th century American surveys were people like black migrants. A famous study from the mid to late 19th century was the working girls of Boston, people looking into industrial accidents, things of that sort that were seen as problematic social issues and needed to be solved. And many reformers and governments and bureaus thought they could be solved by the collecting of empirical information. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened, and I think it's really striking in the early 20th century, is that social researchers expanded their territory. They colonized, if you will, whole new areas of American life and made their subjects, in addition to the one people they had looked at before, they made their subjects ordinary, mainstream Americans, which they usually defined, at least in the early period, as white middle class folks. And this was strikingly new to people who were the subject of some of the early studies of this sort. And the most famous of these was Helen and Robert Lynn's Middletown, 1929 study of Muncie, Indiana, was that they were being studied at all, that researchers could ask them questions about themselves and about their habits and about their children and about their movie watching and things of that sort, questions that wouldn't have been all that unimaginable from survey researchers a generation earlier. And they responded to that in some ways with fascination and others with resistance and challenge. Many people didn't like this turnaround and being considered subjects of a social scientific survey.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that that people at least wanted to challenge this notion of a sample somehow being representative of the larger group, and particularly if the people in the survey, if their attitudes were somehow counter to yours, it's easy to say, well, this doesn't represent me. Was it difficult to get people to this idea that at least statistically you can put together a small group of people, and if you do that right, you can actually get a picture of what the larger group thinks without talking to everybody in the larger group? Was it difficult to sell people on the idea that was actually valid?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really interesting, the history. Many people think the history of statistics is not all that fascinating, of course, but there are some really interesting cultural dimensions, and one is the one that you're speaking of, which is over the course of the 20th century, survey and statistical techniques really took several leaps and bounds. You know, one of them was around 1935 when new measures for sampling and estimating standard errors was invented, essentially. And these techniques made it possible to extrapolate, as you say, from a small number of people to the national population. Now, these measures were always imperfect. They still are, I would argue. But they did allow for new kinds of claims to be made on the basis of very, very small numbers of interviewees or respondents. The study that I mentioned before, Middletown, was not that kind of study. It was a study that was based on one particular community that the researchers interviewed, questioned, tallied in all kinds of ways to come up with a portrait of a typical or representative American town, Middletown. Now, the next study that I was interested in was the arrival of public opinion polling, and that really deviated quite radically from what the Lynns had done, and did exactly you suggest. They used a small handful of respondents to make claims about the national voting population. the surveyors George Gallup and Elmo Roper and Archibald Crossley and others in 1936, who became famous for projecting the election of Franklin Roosevelt within a few percentage points, did so by interviewing several thousand voters, unlike the dominant straw poll of the day, a poll that did not sample in the same way the Literary Digest poll in their techniques and were much more accurate. The Literary Digest poll is another example of an older kind of survey or poll that was conducted in the 19th century. They really began in the 1820s on to assess political opinion. But they weren't samples in the way that we understand them now. They were simply collections of as many people as you could get to answer questions about political candidates or sometimes particular issues like prohibition. Newspapers would conduct them, political partisans would conduct them, and would just simply collect as many opinions as they could on trains, on street corners, amongst their friends, and publicize them. But they could not make the same sort of claim for representativeness that the modern sample surveyors like Gallup could.
Let me introduce again a guest, Sarah Igo. She is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of the book, The Averaged American, Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public. It is published by the Harvard University Press and takes a look at a bit at the history of modern opinion surveying, looking particularly closely at three examples of famous formative surveys that took place in the first half of the last century. And we'll talk a little bit more about them, but basically they're the studies that were done by the Lynds, Robert and Helen Lind, of a place they called Middletown, which was in fact Muncie, Indiana. These were done in 29 and 37. Then the kind of national polls that were done by Gallup and Roper, and of course we still recognize those names as public opinion pollsters, and also the studies of sexual behavior that were done by Alfred Kinsey in 48 and 1953. And she writes about that in the book. And if you're interested in exploring that subject, you can take a look at the book. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here who wants to come into the conversation, and that's fine. This listener is in Urbana. And the line is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a couple of things I was hoping that the speaker could address. I was wondering if she could discuss the impact that surveys and polls might or might not have had on politics over the years, particularly in terms of elections. And also, in terms of presidential elections, we frequently see polls saying, 52% of the voters are likely to vote for candidate X and whatever. But that is the popular vote, whereas the Electoral College vote is actually the one that counts. I was wondering if they do polls to try to predict the outcome of the Electoral College vote, and if so, how that is done, and if that is more complicated than just trying to do a straight popular vote estimate. And I will listen offline.
All right. Well, thank you. Is that something that you can talk about?
Sure. I can say a little bit about that. The effect of polls on politics has been one of the most contentious issues, I would say, that has come along with the rise of the polling industry. In fact, worries, anxieties over what these polls might be doing, creating, that is, rather than simply measuring, were born with the inception of modern public opinion polling in 1935 or 1936. And many people, from people in Congress to people, ordinary citizens, lay people, worried what knowing how other people expressed their views about politics, wonder what that would do to the political outcome. So that's just to say that from a historical view, people have been thinking about this question for a long time. And early on, this term, the bandwagon effect, was coined, which expresses some of those worries. That is, that knowing what other people or who they said they would vote for would affect the outcomes of the results. And certainly this was a concern that many people have expressed from 1936 to the present. The question about how polling for the Electoral College versus the popular vote is a good one. The electoral, certainly pollsters attempt to do both, and it is more complex, I suppose, in certain respects to poll for electoral college results. But polling operations these days have extremely sophisticated operations for figuring out the state-by-state and even county-by-county results of their samples. So that is something that certainly pollsters attempt to do. And when you see during a national election the results that are projected by Gallup or by other big polling organizations, that is in fact what they're doing, unless the question is specifically about what the popular vote will be. So there are different techniques for measuring those two different kinds of political response, the electoral college and the national popular vote, but the kinds of sampling one would do would have to be somewhat different, because you'd have to look at a state by state or district by district kind of count versus a national sample. And to the more general question about polls' effects on politics over the years, I think there are a number of ways I could answer that. One is certainly that we think, anyway, that we know much, much more about how the national currents trend. We are updated almost constantly, some would say relentlessly, about races that are far in the future. It's been interesting to me to see how early the presidential race of 2008 seems to be upon us, and that the last election was hardly over before the next one seemed to begin. So there's a kind of ongoing, constant measuring of American opinion, which of course is going to change quite a bit, and what people think now about the candidates is not what they're going to think by the time the election rolls around in 2008. So one effect on politics has been that polling information itself has become the subject of so much political commentary rather than other kinds of perhaps more substantive topics. So I think in some ways the political effects of polls have been less on elections per se than on the kind of political discourse that is carried on a daily level in the news media and in campaigns. Polling is central to any kind of political campaign. No matter what politicians tell you about not following poll results, they are a feature of modern political life that cannot be escaped, cannot be ignored.
Well, I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the cases that you look at, that you explore closely here, starting with the Middletown study. And as I mentioned, this is a very famous early kind of survey that was done of they called it Middletown in the study, but it was in fact Muncie, Indiana. This was done by a couple, Robert and Helen Lind. And this was something that this kind of study, as I understand it, was new. Nobody had really done this before. What was it that they were hoping to do in their study of Muncie?
They, the Lins were, in a way, transitional figures, I think, between an older form of surveying, which was, again, meant to solve certain kinds of social problems. There were many religious surveys in this period, for example, starting in the late 19th century to the early 20th, trying to figure out how to maintain church attendance, for example. Many studies of different diverse groups in the American population. There were famous studies like W.B. Du Bois's Philadelphia Negro, which examined black life and employment in the city of Philadelphia. So there were lots of those sorts of studies, again, aimed mostly at particular groups or particular problems, and intended for a small audience of reformers, sometimes government bureaucrats. Now, what the Lins did, and they didn't entirely start out with this intention, but wound up doing this, was to examine a town, a particular town that they called representative of modern America, and asked every sort of question that they could devise of school children, of wives, of working class people, of people they called business level people, about daily life, about how they tended their homes, raised their children, whether they attended church and what kind, how they did their daily chores, those kinds of questions, which you wouldn't think would necessarily interest lots of people. people, but wound up, when compiled into the form of a book, Middletown, surprised the publisher and the authors by becoming a national bestseller. It turned out that people were very, very interested in these kinds of daily mundane details about American life. One of the Lynn's biggest findings was that what they called the accident of social class determined so many other things about people's existence, whether one was born into the business or the working class, as they termed them. This was not necessarily the main conclusion that readers derived from their study, but it was very important to the Lynns. They were interested in the processes of industrialization, what they had done to labor mobility, to upward mobility. They were interested in commercial culture and what new forms of entertainment like movies, even the automobile, had on American life and on family structure. And I would say that those things are all in the study and well documented, but what readers got out of it was this glimpse of something that they more and more called typical America, and that the book wound up in a sense, the study wound up in a sense, creating a portrait of mainstream America that was flawed in many respects, which I can talk about, but which in a sense enshrined Midwestern white native Muncie as America for the national press as well as for readers.
Well, one of the things that's certainly striking about this is you should expect a study like this would be of interest to other social scientists, and I'm sure that it was, but it got people just regular people excited. It became a bestseller. It was something that where there was an enormous amount of popular interest, and this for a lot of people seemed to be a big surprise.
Yes, that's right. It was really the first modern social scientific bestseller, and I think there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, one is the style of the book itself. It's never gone out of print. It's a wonderful read, I think, still, and a sociological classic. But I think there were deeper cultural reasons for its arrival on the bestseller charts. And one of those was that 1929, the year in which it came out, was a moment of great turmoil in American life. It came out before the Depression, but it was a book that it captured and, in a sense, simplified mainstream America for people at a time when there were big debates over immigration. Immigration restriction had just been legislated by Congress, when there were many concerns about modern industrial life, about how labor and leisure were being reconstructed. And there was much in the Lynn's portrait of Muncie to be much that was reassuring to people, I think, about who Americans were. The Lynns quite deliberately left out immigrants and African Americans who lived in Muncie from their story, saying that that would have simply complicated their portrait of how life was changing in industrial America. And so the America that shows up in their pages is one that looks rather nostalgic in some ways. It looks like a majority white farm to factory sort of populace, which was not actually at all representative of the United States at the time.
Well, there you point to one of the flaws with the study, that not only their survey, their sample, was not representative of the country, and it wasn't even representative of Muncie, because there were these people that they decided that they weren't going to include. Were there other significant problems with the way the study was conducted?
I should have added that also Jews and Catholics, for the most part, are left out of the study's pages. So there were many, many people who were left out, which is something that would not be tolerated, I think, in a study of a typical community today, for sure. The Lynns were working at a different time and under different kinds of assumptions, as were their audiences. There were certainly other faults that you could find with the study. It was not, in modern survey researchers' terms, a scientific sampling of any kind. It was anecdotal. It certainly reads today more like a journalistic account of life in a medium-sized Middle Western town than a strictly empirical one. It was not particularly objective in the sense that the Lynns had certain kinds of points they wanted to make about the decline of upward mobility in American life, for example. I don't see that as a particular fault, but it was something that that many later social scientists would criticize the study for. But as a portrait, a snapshot of certain kinds of issues in American life in 1929, I think it's still actually very useful. It's just not the kind of study that would be conducted today, partly because it really was so unrepresentative, ironically enough, of what some of the main trends in American life were, and certainly one of those was the huge numbers of immigrants who were in American cities and contributing to the workforce, and certainly its exclusion of African Americans is one of the deeper flaws of the study. And interestingly enough, because Middletown was so well studied by the Lynns in 1929 and then again in 1937, it became a kind of social scientific laboratory for future researchers who are interested in social history and industrial change and so forth. And so it became a kind of test site for all kinds of other surveys, including marketing surveys and the like. And one of the problems with the Lynn starting points, that is that they left out all kinds of people, was that future researchers continued to use their questions and the kinds of populations that they used to answer them in order to do longitudinal comparisons over time. So it's actually only recently that researchers have begun to go back and try to figure out some comparable statistical information about the black population of Muncie, the Jewish population of Muncie, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it actually had some lingering effects well after the Lynn's time into social research on this typical community.
Just have a caller here, and I want to get right to. But just to make one further point, it's what seemed one of the things that seems to be important about the Middletown study, even though you would have to say it has its flaws, is that it seems that here at this point, it started people thinking about the idea that there was such a creature as an average American.
Yes.
Now, maybe it presented an unreal or a distorted picture of what the average American, quote unquote, is. But it sounds as if before this, people really didn't think in those kinds of terms. That they might have thought about, who knows, an average Hoosier or an average Muncian, but certainly people weren't thinking in that sort of a global sense that they would have this idea that there was an average American and that they would measure themselves against that. They would have this sort of statistical construct of what the average is, and then they would look at themselves and look at that and say, well, am I not? You know, how do I measure up?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think before these kinds of surveys came into public consciousness, there were certainly ways that people assessed what was normal or what was average in their own local communities and things like that, but it was not a statistically based idea. It was not a scientific or empirical kind of description that they turned to, and that is exactly what's new about the Middletown study and the surveys that would follow.
We are talking this morning with Sarah Igo. She is assistant professor of history at University of Pennsylvania. Her book, which looks at some of the early history of surveys and opinion research in the United States, is The Averaged American. The subtitle is Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public. It's published by the Harvard University Press and does take a close look at several major surveys that were done in the 1900s. The one that we've been talking about here, Middletown, she also talks about the rise of the major national polling firms, Gallup and Burr, and she also looks at the activities of Alfred Kinsey. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone else here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I think a whimsical, excellent companion piece to your book would be a movie whose title I hope you know, in which the protagonists discover that a small community perfectly replicates the United States. So by coming into the community in secret and casually talking to everybody in the community, they get their opinions on issue X, publish the data, which perfectly predicts how the U.S. will behave. Of course, the way the movie ends is that people discover where the community is, and the publicity and the news people coming into the community completely destroy it as the perfect subset of the United States. Do you happen to know the title of that movie?
Yes, I do. It's a 1947 film, a Jimmy Stewart film called Magic Town.
Oh, neat. I thought that would be a nice way to illustrate many of the concepts that you're bringing up about surveying and how sometimes observing the people affects the way in which they react. Because the once
yes.
they're interviewed by Roper, they say, oh, and they don't necessarily give you an honest opinion.
That's right. No, it's a wonderful film, which I recommend to everybody listening, 1947.
I'm glad you know, remember the title. I have a second different question or comment. I used to argue that a poorly done census is much worse than a well-done survey. I think my illustration was you're going to audit every single accounts receivable. You get your staff, they get tired, they get lazy, they miscalculate numbers. It would be much better to take a 1 in 10 sample, do it accurately, and then do the normal projections with the error rate built in. Is this a reasonable comment to make in terms of the
effectiveness
of
surveys? I'm not so much a policymaker on these kinds of things,
no,
but really think of these things historically.
Question.
But I think that is certainly the argument that's been made again and again by the likes of people like George Gallup and Elmo Roper, who said that these surveys could be much more accurate
right.
than an attempt to encompass lots and lots of different people, if done with accuracy, if done by cross-checking with census reports and things like that to make
right.
sure that you're getting an accurate sample. And they made this argument pretty tirelessly, I think polling agencies still do, against a certain amount of skepticism from the American population who, possibly because of a democratic tradition that says everybody's voice ought to be listened to, resist the idea that somebody else can speak for them. I think this came up again and again in my research. I looked at a lot of people's letters and responses to the early days of polling. And Americans, many of them, just would not trust the results because they themselves had not been asked. And it didn't help that the pollsters again and again attempted to describe scientifically how sampling worked, which they did in public venues. It was this distrust of a technique that seemed magical or somehow fraudulent because it didn't ask every single person their view. And you can still see this in certain ways. I mean, I think the rejection by Congress of scientific sampling in the census, which was a big debate in 2000, is reflective of this view. There were people in Congress who kept calling scientific sampling magical or said that, this would simply invent people rather than asking people their particulars for the census form. So I think, my own view is that beyond something like the census, it's impossible to actually gauge the entire national population through anything but a sample. You have to be aware of the risks and the pitfalls of certain sampling techniques, but it seems to me unrealistic that beyond something like the census, you could do that kind of holistic study anymore.
Well, you anticipated my question about the skepticism that addressed the idea of sampling to increase the accuracy of the census, and that's another illustration of how that did. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Belgium, the nearby community, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. To go along with the previous caller's somewhat skepticism, I'd like to point out that no less of a luminary as Samuel Clemens said there are three types of lies. There's lies, damnable lies, and there's statistics. And the way you manipulate the questions and the way you manipulate the data can make you get pretty much any answer you want.
Yeah, yes, you're absolutely right. Of course, the legitimate national polling agencies try very hard not to do that and have various kinds of tests that they run on their questions. But it's uncontestable to me that, of course, the way that questions are phrased, intentionally or unintentionally, leads to particular kinds of results. And the rise of things like push polling in political polling, motivated research or sponsored research, has only intensified that practice and that problem so that you see people getting exactly the kinds of answers that they want. from questions that seem on the face of it to be neutral. So you're absolutely right. It's useful to remember that phrase from Samuel Clements because it is true that statistics can seem to tell us the truth and numbers seem transparent, but in fact they are just as capable as any other kind of representation to mislead and sometimes to deliberately mislead.
And we seem to find it more in political type things, it seems to me, especially when it comes around presidential election times, that they're just amazing kind of things they come up with. And you say, how can that possibly be true? Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, you talked to Professor Igoe about the fact that that perhaps it took some time for people to come around to accept the idea that you could talk with a small group of people, put together a representative sample, and that then you could draw some within some areas of some margin for error. You could actually draw some assumptions about what the larger populace thought. It took some time for people to accept that idea. Do you think now that that we've gone the other way and that in fact people seem to be less willing to accept the idea, or maybe it's just that the general idea of the poll, they understand that they can be flawed, that people who conduct them may indeed have some kind of agenda, and that now we have come to the point where we tend to be more skeptical of the results of polls?
That's an interesting question. I think there has been lots of skepticism all the way along. Mm-hmm. I think what's different about the early days of polling and today is that in the early days of polling, people weren't resigned to the fact that these surveys would be part of everyday life and that they would be as continuous as they have become, and so challenged them perhaps a little bit more at their base than people do today. I don't think people today believe there's any way of getting rid of polls and, in fact, wouldn't know how to assess opinion without them. And so there's perhaps a bit more resignation along with the dependence on them or the skepticism about them. I think, you know, what is I guess what I would say is that people are quite skeptical about political polls for the reasons this last gentleman was explaining. And what people seem to be less skeptical about are polls of other sorts, telling us what Americans believe about abortion or gun control or any manner of issues that come up in social issue polls, which are not verifiable by an election or anything like that. These are just as ubiquitous, and we see them in the newspaper all the time. We hear them on the radio. We encounter them, and I think don't judge them with the same kind of skeptical eyes that we do the political polls, because we know who's behind the political polls. We know that there are certain interests at work. And this, I think, may be a larger problem in some sense than the political polls, because this is how we believe we know what the population wants and what it believes. One of the famous examples of this, and I won't myself recall the exact numbers, was a question that was put to the American public about welfare. And when respondents were asked about whether they supported welfare, the numbers were very negative. They were in the, 70 or 80% of Americans said they did not support welfare, something along those lines. But when the question was asked, do you think that the government ought to support or help poor people, the numbers were dramatically reversed. 70 or 80% said, sure, the government should aid poor people. So there you see that problem of question wording again, that a term that has become politicized and has negative connotations, welfare, bent the responses in a certain way. And you wouldn't know that without a lot of playing around with the question wording and so forth, but it could certainly lead to all kinds of consequences if that were the only question asked. Politicians, policy leaders, even ordinary people would think that, in fact, our political system and our population does not support a certain kind of government program, and you can imagine the repercussions that would have. And to me, that seems almost more worrisome than the influence of political polls, which, after all, have a final kind of answer and a final kind of proof in the voting booth.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is someone in Champaign, line one.
Yeah, In terms of, was there a relationship between the development of propaganda and, you know, the measurement of attitude and attitude change in terms of this, you know, survey research for polling?
Was there a connection between the two?
Yeah, because what happened, I know later on it was used, the idea of attitude and attitude change was the idea of, you know, you determine what the attitude is and all that kind of thing, and then measure it and then do some kind of program and see whether there's been a change, you know, what the change was. But, you know, the development of propaganda during World War One, I think, is when the early development of it, and then later on, you know, trying to measure it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Social scientists right around World War One and into the 20s were very engaged by questions of propaganda and, in fact, very proudly talked about propaganda that they were using to fight the war and so forth. And there definitely is a deep connection, social science connection between propaganda research and attitude research. They came about at similar times and had some similar questions at their root. Now, what is interesting is that those people who considered themselves to work on questions about propaganda and influence and suasion and so forth were a separate group than people like the opinion pollsters, who, as you might imagine, had to be very, very careful about claiming that their techniques were transparent, were simply recording what people thought rather than influencing what people thought, because that would make them propagandists. That would make them people who were trying to influence, say, elections or opinion rather than simply communicating it from the people to legislators or other kinds of decision makers. So even though they often use the same kinds of techniques, people like George Gallup and Elmo Roper were very, very, very careful in their public statements and in their work to try to distinguish themselves from propagandists or people who were working on attitude research for other ends. So it was a fine line, as you might imagine, but they were quite careful about this. And, you know, the other interesting historical point here is that a lot of attitude research that was going on in this same early period, World War One and 1920s, 1930s, was also for the purpose of advertising and marketing, a different kind of propaganda, you might say. That was actually something that all the early pollsters were involved in. It's what made them their income, actually. Gallup worked for places like Walt Disney and other corporations, helping to improve the profitability of movie making, and he worked for Young and Rubicam, the advertising marketing agency, for many, many years. And there again, these attitude researchers who in that case wanted to influence people and to try to sell products to them kept that work very separate from the kind of work they were doing in the political and social opinion polls. So they were very, very careful to keep those kinds of work separate, at least in their public pronouncements. But one could ask the question whether they really believed that it was possible to collect all this information on attitudes without influencing anybody. George Gallup would say throughout his career that the bandwagon effect, the idea that people would vote like other people simply because they knew how they were voting, was an illusion, was not true, that American voters simply expressed their views and that was that, and he tallied them. But your question raises the issue whether that could have been possible given what other social scientific researchers were finding about the effects of attitudes on other people and the effects of numbers on attitude formation.
Yeah, just finally, the somatic differential, which is widely used, was Osgood, and actually was developed. It was while he was at the University of Illinois at the College of Communications, and then finally, Lazarfeld studies.
Yes.
Very interesting in terms of voting behavior. Are you familiar with that or not?
Yes, yes. Lazarsfeld and his work on influence of opinion leaders on different groups. This is exactly what I mean by saying that there was lots of social scientific research around at this time that suggested that opinion was not just a matter of collecting people's anonymous opinions and publicizing it, but that people had effects, people's attitudes had effects on each other. And Paul Lazarsfeld's work, Elihu Katz's work, for instance, these mid-century social researchers was all about that kind of social pressure or social influence. But the pollsters, again, really kept themselves away from that sort of research or that kind of recognition, at least as it had to do with political opinion polls.
Oh, I want to thank the caller. We have maybe about 5 minutes left here, and I have one more caller. I want to get this person in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to return to the two studies in 29 and 37 on Muncie and ask about sample size and weighting of the results. What do you know about that in those instances?
There was really no attempt by the Linz at that time to address those kinds of questions, no weighting whatsoever. This was a study that tabulated interviews, questionnaires of school children, things like that, without an attempt that you know a modern survey researcher would make to weigh and balance those kinds of numbers. So really, this is why today the Linz, and even by the later 30s and 40s, why the Linz were considered amateur social scientists, very good observers, a transitional team to modern survey research, but not actually survey researchers in the modern sense.
But how many people did they talk to in the interview?
Oh, how many people did they talk to? They interviewed somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 people at different points. They did not do this terribly systematically, so it's a little bit hard to come up with exact numbers. They would... They did a lot of historical research.
Wasn't even a true random sample.
No, there was no random sampling. That was not part of their study particularly. They did try to talk to as many working class families as they could and as many business class families as they could and then tallied the results. But there was nothing quite like the random sampling that we would expect today.
And what was the size of the community, Muncie, Indiana, at those two time periods? In other words, they were talking to 500 or so people out of that community, but what was the size of that community?
The size of the community in 1929 was, I believe, 37 or 38,000. And I'm forgetting the size of population increase in the later study, the mid-30s, when the Linz were conducting their work.
But a similarly sized, small sampling.
Yes,
I mean, proportionately,
yes.
It was a small number
out of the total community. Yeah, but the Linz, but as opposed to actually, it's an interesting question because as opposed to later kinds of surveys, the Linz lived in the community for a year and a half. While they formally interviewed a small number of people in the community, they did live amongst them and they went to church services and business meetings and rotary meetings and things like that. So a lot of the information in that study is of a different sort, a qualitatively different sort than you would find in a modern sample survey.
Yeah, indirect information, in other words.
Yeah, and very
written
detailed
up as
information.
As part of the data, but not technically part of the sampling or interviewing, I mean.
That's right, although they did a lot of the survey where you to look at it is the background information that they gained from talking to, you know, leaders in town,
yes,
to community spokespeople, things like that. So it's a little bit hard to compare those early studies to later ones because in some ways it was much richer and much fuller information that they were gathering, almost ethnographic information.
But it was for even original purposes, it was a small proportion of the universe that they were talking about.
Yes, no, that's certainly true. Just as opinion polls are a very smaller sample, actually, of the universe that they claim to speak for today.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. Just to finish up here, and we have maybe a minute or two, I want to give you the chance to talk at least a little bit about Kinsey, because this certainly is an example of what kind of impact the surveys that we're talking about can have. I like very much here, you have a quote here from the National Conference of Social Work, 1949. This side of the atomic bomb, there has been no incident which has created more stir in the personal lives of people than has the Kinsey Report.
Yes, the Kinsey Report. It's actually funny that we spend so much time talking about the opinion pollsters and the Lins, because the Kinsey Reports are have been a very hot topic for a very long time.
Yeah,
still very controversial, yeah. Actually. Yep, the Kinsey Reports moving social scientific research into the terrain, very, very private, intimate behavior, sexual matters, was shocking to people, was deeply influential in terms of upending conventional ideas of what Americans did in the privacy of their homes, and seemed to many to call for a new kind of morality or a new radically different kind of picture of who Americans were. Many people certainly resisted Kinsey's conclusions and also his techniques. If there was ever a study where people challenged the representativeness of its sample, it was the Kinsey Reports. But ultimately, I think that those surveys, the 1948 and the 1953 surveys of sexual behavior in men and women, probably had one of the greater impacts that social scientific study has had in the entirety of the 20th century.
Yeah. But both fair to say, just as a way of summing up, that what we're the activity that we're talking about, and here are these early examples, did indeed have an important impact on how Americans thought about themselves as individuals and as a nation.
Absolutely. I think it has been a mistake to underestimate the power of empirical survey data on the ways that Americans think about the national public, about their place within it, even about their own identities in the case of the Kinsey Reports, when one could discover that one shared certain kinds of predilections with another segment of the population. That had to have changed, and it did change, I believe, certainly in my research looking at Kinsey's correspondence, how one thought about oneself. So I think these numbers have very deep effects in some ways, ones that we haven't fully reckoned with, again, because they are so ubiquitous in our public life that we think of them as normal, just the way we know things, rather than as a particular kind of knowledge that we ignore, maybe at our peril.
All right. Well, there we must stop. If you would like to read this book, the title is The Averaged American: Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public, published by the Harvard University Press, by our guest, Sarah Igo. She is assistant professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Right at the moment, she's on leave, and she is at Yale. And we also want to say thanks to the engineer there, Philip Kearney, for being on the other end. And Professor Igo, we want to say to you, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for your questions and your interest.